lecture on this advanced course on classical mechanics. So yesterday I showed you this beautiful description of Hamiltonian mechanics, which was done using the symplectic geometry approach. But basically, we had to limit ourselves to Hamiltonians which are time independent. So if the Hamiltonian is time independent, you have n q's, n p's, so your space is actually 2n dimensional. And actually then the symplectic geometry is the right thing to use for your description. And so symplectic geometry was defined by this symplectic two-form omega, and this two-form omega was non-degenerate. So you did your exercise yesterday on Mathematica where you took arbitrary 2x2 matrix, anti-symmetric, and you show that basically a generic case is that omega is non-degenerate, so which means that you have all eigenvalues which are non-zero, right? So it was precisely our case of the symplectic geometry. So now we want to actually restore the time as well. So we want to extend our description to put time here as well. And in order to do that, actually we have to go beyond the realms of symplectic geometry. We have to study something which is called contact geometry. So that's what I will do today. So part H. It's called contact geometry. And so let me start with a definition. And it's about studying, you know, what possible two forms you can have, basically. And so the definition is the following: a vector x for which two-form omega evaluated on x and y gives you zero for all y is called a null vector. Two-form omega. Okay, so basically, if you want to describe it in terms of our hooks, what it means is that I take x hook omega, and this will be always zero. Okay, so this is zero. Then you call this vector x as a special vector, which is associated to your two-form omega, and then it's called null vector. In other words, it's nothing else. Then, you know, if you think about omega as a matrix, so you can write this as omega x up to a minus sign equals to zero, which means that x is the eigenvector of your matrix omega, which corresponds to the eigenvalue equal to zero. So this is what it means. Okay, so this you call null vector. Another definition, you call a two-form omega is non-singular when the vector space spanned by these null vectors, so generated by its null vectors, has the maximal dimension. Minimal. Has, of course, that would be stupid, minimal possible dimension. And you have seen a proof yesterday by experimental proof by using Mathematica that if you have even dimensional space, actually the dimension of this space generated by null vectors is zero, whereas if you have odd dimensional space, you always get one eigenvalue which is zero. Okay, so then it's one dimensional. So you have two possibilities, either the dimension is equal to zero, which is when you have even dimensional manifold, or the dimension equals to one when you have all dimensional manifold, 2n+1. And this was shown yesterday in tutorial by Gong. Just almost a proof, right? So if you test it on Mathematica for random matrices, it's probably true. Okay. So that's our second definition. So now we know what a non-singular two-form omega is. So now let us define what the contact geometry is, and it's exactly the odd-dimensional version of the symplectic geometry. So definition, the pair so now we are in odd dimensions, 2n+1 dimensional manifold, and omega is called a contact geometry if omega is closed and non-singular. So in other words, it has only one dimensional space of null vectors. Yes. Okay, so before I define non-degenerate as the one which has all the eigenvalues non-trivial, so now I allow one eigenvalue in all dimensions and zero eigen. So it's like a generalization. So you can still call this non-degenerate thing, but you are in all dimensions, so you always have this one zero eigenvalue. You cannot avoid that.
Yeah, but then in given dimension,
it's the same thing. In even dimensions, the same thing, but now this extends to all dimensions as well. So of course, so note, you may expect that this is nothing else than an odd dimensional version of symplectic geometry. And interestingly, people didn't like odd-dimensional version of the symplectic geometry at the very beginning. So they thought it's just very very weird and odd. And now I have some degenerate direction here with this null vector which exists always for every omega. But later on, actually, they realized it's very useful. And I would say that's equally useful as symplectic geometry at this point, maybe even more useful. Okay, so it's a very nice piece of mathematics if you want the contact geometry. Okay. So now, of course, locally, because omega is closed, it will be again locally generated by some one form, which is now called contact one form. Okay, so omega generated at least locally by contact one form. Theta. So we have many thetas. We have theta L, we have theta for a symplectic geometry, now we have theta for contact geometry. I will distinguish them later, of course, such that d theta equals to omega. And so because this theta determines what omega is, it also determines what your null direction is. Okay, so as long as this is really a non-singular two-form which you generate, it uniquely determines the direction x, of course, up to some multiplication, right? So up to normalization of x is already determined. So from here, you also have basically uniquely so-called vortex direction. It's just precisely your null vector x by saying that x hook omega equals to zero. So this is then uniquely determined as long as the omega which you create in this way is actually non-singular. Okay, and this is all unique. So specifically, actually, if you normalize this thing, if you normalize your vector x, then you give it a special name. And the special name maybe you've seen somewhere, it's called read vector. And then something which plays central role in this. So specifically, you would call x a read vector. If it's normalized, meaning that theta, which is my one form, it eats my vector x and gives me one. Okay, so three vector is such vortex direction x, which is normalized, theta x equals to one. And that plays central role in many nice things. So it's one, two. So if you are interested in geometry, you may forget about classical mechanics, you may forget about physics, but it's a beautiful subject in mathematics, and that's called, it's a subject which actually deals with special Riemannian manifolds. So let me just say two words about it. So, three. So there's an interesting branch of mathematics which is called special Riemannian manifolds. By the way, people like Rob Myers, Raphael Sorkin, they have dealt with these special Riemannian manifolds in the past. Also an expert, Tibre is actually an expert on special Riemannian manifolds. So if you are interested in these subjects, talk to these people. Also Leighton Boyle actually studied them. So it's some quite interesting. And so you have basically two types of manifolds, which are nice and special. So the first type is called Kähler manifold. And that's precisely if you are in even dimensions and your omega is non-singular and everything, and it's closed, but in addition to that, it satisfies some nice additional properties, so-called integrable, the covariant derivative is zero, and so on. So then the omega is actually called Kähler 2 form, but it's just a special case of symplectic geometry, if you want. Okay. So you have Kähler manifolds, and they are very, very important in string theory, and they are very important. Mathematicians are really interested in these things. The odd-dimensional version of this is so-called Sasaki manifolds, and then you are in 2 and plus 1 dimensions. And then the central role is played by this read vector. So again, it's a special case, if you want, of a contact geometry. But now you impose. So basically, you impose on your omega and on your x, you impose additional conditions, which you don't require in contact geometry or symplectic geometry. So if you're interested in pure mathematics, of course, these, again, have applications in string theory. For example, if you really believe in string theory and you believe that you live in 11-dimensional space, whatever, you need to somehow compactify to 4 dimensions. And this compactification is exactly done on the scalar or Sasaki manifolds, right? So if I want to compactify from 11 to 4, it means I need to kill 7 dimensions, so that compactified space will be a Sasaki manifold. And moreover, and so on. So these really, really play an interesting role. And they are basically like contact and symplectic geometries. So if you want to do your essay on these things, ask Tibre, for example. Okay. So four. It's obvious that once I find my vortex direction x, it will actually preserve my non-singular two-form omega. And the proof is simple. So again, I use the Cartan's lemma, right? So Lx omega equals to x hook d omega plus d x hook omega. So now I have a closed two-form. So this is 0. And by definition, x hook omega x actually zero, right? It's a zero eigenvector. So this is zero. So of course this is zero. So trivially, omega will be preserved by x. So you will see later on that, of course, this is sort of a definition of a canonical transformation. Remember yesterday I said, well, canonical transformation is something which preserves the form of omega, right? So we are saying here, I'm preserving the form of omega as I move along this direction. So that in particular show, so now I take x, which generates my dynamical time evolution. So what this actually tells you that the time evolution is a canonical transformation. Okay, so specifically, what it means is that specifically a time evolution is equal to canonical transformation because you precisely define as we did yesterday that the canonical transformation what it means is basically L x equals to omega if x is your dynamical vector field which generates your time translation, right? Okay. Finally, we have an odd dimensional version of the Darboux theorem, as we had yesterday, or the day before, so 5. There is, again, the Darboux theorem. And that basically will tell you how people are stupid when they consider non-trivial Hamiltonians. Okay, I'll explain that later on. But anyway, so what it means. So again, so since omega is closed and non-singular, singular, then again I can find a coordinate system, canonical coordinates, canonical coordinates. So now I'm in all dimensions, so I will have n q's, n p's, and in addition I will have one extra. Okay, so I'll call it T, QI, PI, and T, such that the omega alpha beta as a matrix takes the form, again, what we had before, so 0, minus 1, 1, 0 type of blocks, right? And I can do that many times. Okay, minus 1, 1, 0, and 0 on the diagonal. But then I have this extra direction, that plus 1 direction, and in that I have to have 0. That's precisely the 0 eigenvalue which you are getting there. And everywhere else it's 0. Okay, so that's your canonical form of omega. Again, you can always do it because you know that omega is closed and non-singular. Okay, which means that omega, if I write it as a form, takes the form omega equals to dp dq, or if you want dpi dqi. So it's exactly the form as before, because the last direction doesn't apply. It's just has zero eigenvalue there. Okay, and then if you stare at this definition of x and stare at this form of omega, do you know what the corresponding vertex direction will be in these coordinates? So what is x? So control question. Sorry? Exactly. So now this is exactly the direction which is in addition to what you had. So this is your canonical form of your null direction or vertex direction, if you want. So by the way, you can also define an analog of Poisson brackets. These Poisson brackets, which you define using this omega here, of course, would be degenerate in one direction. So you have to do something more clever. And if you do something more clever, you get something which is called Lagrange brackets. But so they can be defined. They still have some nice properties, but not so many nice properties as Poisson brackets. So let me not do that. But it's possible to define Poisson brackets using this structure as well. Okay, yes? It's just, you know, several, you know, different terminologies are used for the same thing. So basically, the null direction here, if I have non-degenerate thing, is the same thing as vortex direction, is the same as rib vector if I normalize it. So all these three concepts are actually the same thing. Sorry, you're asking about omega equals to d theta?
Yeah.
Well, you can always locally do that, right?
I mean, like, I just confused that, like, why do you write everything in one thing? I mean, is there any relationship between d theta equals omega and definition of
No, no. So, okay, so that's a good question. So, you know that omega, well, I can definitely generate omega, which will satisfy all my properties by this contact one form, right? Locally, I can always do that. So the statement is, I can define omega to be d theta. So that's the first statement. Second statement is, once I have omega, there'll be a unique prescription how to find this x as long as omega is actually non-singular, okay? So basically, you can say that the contact one form also generates your x. So people studying contact geometry, so it's interesting. So if you study symplectic geometry, your central object is usually the symplectic two form, omega. When people study contact geometry, the central object is usually contact one form, theta. And interestingly, this omega doesn't have any name. So you can call it contact two form, but people don't do it. So people treat actually theta as more fundamental when you are in all dimensions, for no reason, and omega as more fundamental if you are in even dimensions. Interesting. I don't know. Yes? Yes, you can. You can do, it's a good question. There are many, many lifts which you can do. So basically, lifting means that you define extra quantities. Let's say I can define like a conjugate quantity to T, lift the whole thing to an even dimensional space, 2n plus 2 dimensional space, and use the symplectic description, for example. Yes, there are lots of these lifts. There's Jacobi lift, there is Darboux lift, there is, who is this guy? Many, many lifts. Yeah, so you can do that. But let me just discuss this odd dimensional version. Of course, yeah. So I wrote a paper about it, so you can you can read a paper, yeah. Other questions?
So why is an artificial manifold have
that relation to all vectors? There was this proof by demonstration Mathematica yesterday. So you can really show that always, if you are in all dimensions, the two form has to have one eigenvalue, which is zero. So there always exists this x. So if I look at this as an eigenvalue problem, you can always find one x, one direction x, one dimensional x, which satisfies omega dot x equals to zero. Zero is the eigenvalue zero, right? So if I have an eigenvalue problem, omega times v equals to lambda times v, right? So this is my eigenvalue problem. So now the statement is, there's always one eigenvalue which is zero. So I have omega v equals to zero, and you can always find one V, which V satisfies this. Okay, so now we know the contact geometry. So now let's apply it to mechanics, right? So for that, we do, okay, so this is path I, so we H, GH, I don't know, extended phase space. And for definition, you will call an extended phase space, will be a manifold which is now Well, your original phase space, which is the cotangent bundle over C, times time. Okay, so dimension is now is 2n plus 1. And the coordinates are p1 to pn, q1 to qn, and t. Right? So extended phase space, you just include time as one of the coordinates, and this is what it is. Oh, so C is the configuration space of your mechanical problem, and this is just the cotangent bundle on that. So basically, this is our former phase space. Now we extend it by including this R, by including this T here. So now, of course, you want to define dynamics on this extended phase space, and for that you need the Hamiltonian. So given a Hamiltonian function, which will be a map from my manifold to R, of course, so it's a function of these coordinates, all these coordinates, q, I, and t. The extended phase space, so M, admits the following contact one form. And how you define it is, well, I don't have space here. So theta, so this is what you had before, plus an extra direction. So it's pi dqi. This is what we had before. And now you want to extend this to this extra dimension dt. So you define it minus h dt. Okay, so that's the statement. So given h, I can always define this contact one form. And of course, if I find omega, which is d theta, so omega is the d theta, it will be dpi dqi minus dh h dt. This is your contact two form if you want. Okay, so that's the definition. So now, of course, you want to show that this is non-degenerate and so on. It's closed, it's obvious. Non-degenerate, actually, it will be also the case. Well, precisely. So this is what we had before. In even dimensions, this was non-degenerate. So even if this actually generates extra eigenvalue 0, we don't care, right? So this definitely has rank at least 2n.
But it makes sense to take into account that
oh, that's right. It's a good point. And of course, you know, this thing, well, this is really stupid what people do, right? So you can always set, and I will show you, you can always set h equals 0, and it doesn't matter, right? So this is precisely that. You can always go to these Darboux canonical coordinates where omega takes this form. So now I'm adding this term h dt for some reason, right? I want to talk about Hamiltonian, so I'm adding that there. But of course, there's a change of coordinates always into these canonical coordinates, so that h is 0. It's precisely the Hamilton-Jacobi theory, where I set h equal to 0 by hand, right? And you can always do it. So anyway, so this is how people do when they discuss the standard Hamilton's formalism. They really put the h there, but it really doesn't make my two form more non-degenerate than it is already. Right? It's a good point. So anyway, so what the claim is now that, and hence, my M and omega is a contact manifold. By the way, how people came up with this theta, well, if you look at that and you integrate it, so anybody recognizes something familiar? if I integrate theta, is it any familiar? Exactly. So that's actually integrating theta will give you the action, right? And so that's your standard action principle. So that's how people came up with this theta, if you want. Okay. Okay. So now, once we have this, we of course want to find what is our corresponding vertex direction x, right? So given omega, we want to find what is our x. So the corresponding vortex field and you can verify this yourself using Mathematica if you want, but basically what I have to do is I have to solve this x, the eigenvalue problem x dot omega equals to zero, right? So if you solve that, you find out that x equals to th over d bj d over dqj minus dh over dqj d over dpj plus d over dt. Okay, so this is from solving x hook omega equals to zero. So I know what my omega is, it's given here. So I really have to solve this eigenvalue problem, do it using Mathematica if you can, and this is the solution. Of course, omega now depends on h, right? So that's why h actually appears here. Okay. So this is the solution of the eigenvalue problem. Now you, of course, require this to be an integral curve of this x to have corresponding integral curves, right? So it's integral curves So now if you look at the picture, so now we are in this extended phase space, right? So what's going on? So I have Q here, I have P here, and then I have T here. So that's my extended phase space, right? So now in this extended phase space, I want to find integral curves where this x is always tangent to these integral curves, right? So these integral curves, as always, will be denoted by gamma. But now, because I use t as one of the coordinates to parameterize my gamma, my curves, I have to use a different letter, right? So I am using some parameter which characterizes my curves. And this parameter, let's choose it tau, okay? So gamma of tau, and tau really tells me where on the curve I am, okay? So this is my, so the integral curves are actually gamma tau is qj of tau, and then bj of tau, and t of tau. Okay, so this is my integral curve. And to express that x is actually regenerates these integral curves, we just have the standard formula. So it's qj dot d over dqj plus bj dot d over dpj plus t dot d over dt. Okay, so it's dx mu over dt, d over dx mu. Now my coordinates are q, p, and t. Okay, so of course I want to simplify my life, and I want to say that, well, I don't want that t dot there in order to compare with whatever I have above. So what it means is that I am choosing tau equal to t, okay, which you can do as long as you know this. So upon identification, upon identifying tau equals to t, so this is dt. Okay, so this dot here means d over d tau, right? Right, because this is function of tau. So I have dt over d tau. If tau is equal to t, this is 1, and it's just gone. So upon identity, this just becomes 1. And then I can compare whatever I see here and whatever I see there. And of course, you get the Hamilton's canonical equations again. Okay, so we get that TH over DPJ equals to whatever stands here. So it's QJ dot, and then minus TH over DQJ, QJ equals to whatever stands here, and it's PJ dot. So that's your canonical equations. So see, we are basically copying what we have done yesterday, but now with extra dimension T, right? So that's Hamilton equations. Again, you can get them free for free, basically saying, well, I have a natural structure on my extended phase space. This is this theta for a given Hamiltonian. And then I solve this problem. So, this theta really determines my special direction, which of course depends on the choice of H. If I choose different H, I will have a different direction, maybe. Okay. And then the fact that this has to actually generate some integral curves gives you Hamilton's equations. Okay. And so, of course, so X determines time evolution, if you want, minus time evolution so for any function f, for any f, and you define this to be x acting on f, which is your number, which is d f over dt. And so now what it is, you look here. So now let me use the definition of the Poisson brackets which we used before. So now what you see there is just a Poisson bracket between h. So if I put f there, it's Poisson bracket between h and f, and then I have extra term d over dt, right? So this is what it is. It's f h plus d over dt of f, right? So it's this equation here. So the Poisson bracket here is defined as I had it before. Right. So as I said, this is not a natural structure on this contact thing. On this thing, you can define Lagrange brackets. But let me just use the Poisson brackets, which you already know. Okay. You could write this in terms of the Lagrange brackets, but it's not so nice, and people don't use it. So let's use the standard Poisson brackets as you know them from an even dimensional case. Okay, so now you have the full time evolution, including this df over dt term. Right? Isn't that beautiful? Questions? No. Okay, so what you are just saying is that I parameterize my curves not by tau but by t. So as long as there's an isolation between tau and t, you can still do it, right? So yeah. It's just a different parameter which characterizes your curve, and if this is well defined, then yeah, you're not really destroying anything. I just yeah. So. Now, last thing I want to discuss in this framework is basically the generalization of these canonical transformations. So again, you define a canonical transformation where you now allow to transform time as well. Transformation QJ, what the hell? QJ is a function of QI, PI, and T as well. And then PJ is a PJ, QI, PI, and T as well. You will call this a canonical. It's canonical if it preserves the form of my omega. So preserves the form of omega. That means that exactly what we had before. So there exists, you know, a new Hamiltonian H prime, which is a function of Qj, Pj, and T, such that the form of omega doesn't change, meaning such that omega in the old coordinates, which means dpj dqj minus hdt minus dh hdt equals to the same thing in the new coordinates. So it's d big pj d big qj minus dh prime hdt. Okay, so this is what you require, and then you call the transformation canonical one. Okay. And so that's your definition of a canonical transformation, if you want. And so exactly as yesterday, you may now show that all such canonical transformations are generated by a generating function. And the proof goes exactly the same way as we did yesterday. So having, you know, two contact one forms. So which means I have theta small pj dqj minus h dt such that omega equals to d theta, and then theta tilde in the new coordinates, pj, dqj, and minus h prime dt, such that omega is d theta tilde. Then if I subtract omega from omega, I get zero, which means d theta, which means d theta minus theta tilde equals to zero, which means that these guys have to be df. So you locally showed that actually there must be a generating function which satisfies this thing here, right? So we find that, you know, f will be a generating function. So in particular, if you take f to be whatever we have done before, f, qj, and t now, then the equation which you have found, that one here, tells you that, well, small pj, so theta minus theta tilde equals to df, that's your equation, right? So p, so theta is this thing here, pj d qj minus h dt, that's my theta, minus theta tilde, so this is theta, minus theta tilde is minus big Pj dqj plus h prime dt. Okay. So this is minus theta tilde equals to df, right? But df, f is now function of q and big q. So it's df over dqj, dqj plus df over d big qj, dqj. And then, of course, it's also a function of t, so it's plus df over dt, dt. Okay, that's my df. So now by comparing whatever you have on the left-hand side is whatever you have on the right-hand side. Okay, so let's look at what stands in front of dqj, say first. So in front of dqj, I have small pj on the left-hand side. That's the only thing which stands in front of dqj. And then on the right-hand side, I have df over dqj. So that's one equation.
Df over dqj.
So that's one thing you get, one condition. Now, let's look at what stands in front of big qj. So it's on the left-hand side, it's minus pj And then on the right-hand side is TF over the big QJ, right?
QJ.
And let's finally look at what stands in front of DT. And what stands in front of DT is H prime minus H on the left-hand side. And on the right-hand side is DF over DT. And so if you look at your notes, this is precisely the conditions which we derived a long time ago, just using the standard approach. But now we actually show that, every canonical transformation is generated by this F, at least locally. Yes? Yeah, I'll do that. Yeah. Well, so there's a physical interpretation for theta. So theta, if you integrate theta, theta is a one form. You integrate it over a curve or something like that. So this is precisely your action. So the interpretation of theta is basically an action. So now omega is a d of that. So like a differential of the action. I don't know. Okay. Yeah, well, if you use Stokes' theorem, yes. Yeah, so exactly. So basically, you may say something like, I have like two passes which go from one point to another. So I can go this pass or that pass. And then you are saying, so what is it you are saying? So omega, it's an interesting question. I don't know. No, it's just one possibility. Yeah. No, I just showed you that always you have to have df, so f always exists locally. Yeah. But now I'm just saying, for example, let's take this f. Okay. Right. So this is just a specific example which may work. Generically, it will work, but for some cases it may not work. Yeah. Okay. So this is the derivation using the contact geometry of the same thing. So finally. Let me just really tell you that, we have this beautiful theorem here, which is saying we are stupid. We are choosing our omega to be more complicated than we need to, right? So let's do the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Or maybe we want to keep this one. Okay. So just have in mind this Darboux theorem here. J, let's do the Hamilton-Jacobi theory again. And let's not do it the whole thing again, but let's just give it a geometrical interpretation. So Hamilton-Jacobi theory revised. So the idea is, of course, the same thing. So idea, let's make a special canonical transformation, so that in new coordinates QJ and PJ and T, these coordinates are the Darboux coordinates, or the Darboux canonical coordinates, are the Darboux canonical coordinates. Okay, so that's the idea of the Hamilton-Jacobi theory for our for omega. And of course, the Darboux theorem says you can always do it. So there's always a coordinate transformation which transforms my omega into this form. And okay, so the only thing which you have to show is that this is a canonical transformation. But you have a specific prescription for this, how to do it, and that's the Hamilton-Jacobi equation. Right, so I will not go through that, but basically what this means as a picture, so that is, you require that omega now takes the form dpj over dqj, and there is no minus dh dt because you set that equal to zero, so you have h prime equals to zero. Of course, that means also that my x is just d over dt, right? So this is the idea of the Darboux thing. So the corresponding picture is that this is what I start with. You have t and small q and small p, and now your vector field, you know, is an ugly vector field which can make some interesting curves in your extended phase space. In particular, if I start, let's say, here at Q0, P0, and T0, then later on, I will have different Q, P, and T. Okay? And this is my gamma of T or gamma of tau, doesn't matter. And my vector field X goes in general in all possible directions. Right? So this is what you start from, and this is what how people do mechanics when they think about, you know, this extended space, and they define theta minus hdt. Okay, so this is what you have. And the statement is, now I can do a canonical transformation to these Darboux coordinates. So now I have t, and then big Q and big P. Okay, so that my field only goes in the t direction, right? So in other words, how does it look like? It's a straight line, exactly. So now your field will be just straight lines which go only along the t direction. In particular, if you start at some q0 and p0 and t0, you end up at the same q0, p0, but now t. So the only thing which flows is the time, okay? So you have that actually your qj actually remain constant during a motion, right? So that's the geometrical meaning of the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Okay, so qj equals to alpha j equals to a constant, and then pj equals to minus beta j equals to a constant by construction. Okay, so this is the meaning of the Hamilton-Jacobi theory. Really, that I you know, just change coordinates so that my vector field goes only in the direction of time. Equation that the generating function satisfies ES of AT plus H DY TS over DQI and T equals to zero. And this was the explicit construction that you used before.
I think you actually have written over here somewhere in terms of F, instead of S. You're behind this board.
Okay, so it's choose.
It's covered up right now. But.
Yeah, it's possible, yeah.
But yeah, if F equals S.
Yes, or yeah, maybe, yeah, maybe. Anyway, so this is the idea of the Hamilton Jacobi theory. So now you see, actually, so at the time when Hamilton Jacobi came with that idea, it was a crazy idea, right? It was combination, this idea, nobody would come with that. But if you have this geometrical description of what you are doing, and you see, you know, it's something everybody can come up with this idea, right? Everybody can almost do this. So that's the beauty of the description. Okay, questions to this? So if there are no questions, I would like to summarize what we have done in this course, just, you know, for you to have some overview. So let's just do a summary. And then possible future directions, if you want. Summary. So we have seen that actually classical mechanics, you know, find this natural description in this language of symplectic and compact geometry, right? So I think that's pretty nice. So classical mechanics finds natural description in terms of symplectic and compact geometry. So symplectic one will be if you either do not consider things time dependent or if you actually live them above the question. And the compact one is if they are time dependent and you want to do the ordinary version of the geometries. So now let me draw a table for you. So how this really works, it'll be like a summary of what we have done. So we have discussed the Hamiltonian picture. And then we discussed the Lagrangian picture a little bit, but only very briefly, basically. And so in both pictures, you can give a symplectic description or compact geometric description. So symplectic one here, symplectic here, and then the compact one here, right? And then we discussed briefly Lagrangian one, but basically what we have done there is we discussed the symplectic one. You can do the other one as well. Okay. That's the Hamiltonian description. That's the contact description. So the first thing which you have to discuss when you discuss geometrical formulation of these things is where your things live. So you have to specify the manifold, right? So manifold M is my first column. So what is your manifold in the symplectic description of the Hamiltonian thing? It's the phase space, exactly. So it's phase space. And what is it? It's cotangent bundle of my configuration space. So in the symplectic description, I have 2n dimensional description. In the compact one, I have 2n plus 1 dimensional description. So what is the manifold in the compact one?
Times R,
exactly. So it's this extended phase space, if you want. Extended phase space. And so it's P star C times R, where you include the time as well. So what is the manifold in the Lagrangian
space?
It's TC, and it's called velocity phase space.
How
space and then the PC. Okay, so we specify the manifold. So next thing is what specifies your dynamics, right? So dynamics. So what specifies my dynamics in the Hamiltonian friction symplectic case?
The symplectic form. The symplectic form.
Symplectic form, yes. But in order to really know what is my concrete dynamics, I specify
Hamiltonian.
Oh. Right? Yeah. Exactly. And so in this case, it's considered H. As a function, so it's the Hamiltonian H, which is now only a function of Q's and P's, but there's no T dependence. Right? In the contact one, I have again Hamiltonian, but it will be a function of T as well. So H, Q, P, and T, I allow this. What is it, the Lagrangian description? Exactly. So here it will be Lagrangian. So now because I am only on TC, I have a function of Q dot and no T. And again, you can do the contact version of that if you want. So now, one I don't need. Thing which is important is what is, you know, there's some characteristic one form in your description. So, what is the one form in case of the simple geometry? It's called Cartan. Yeah. Cartan one form, exactly. And as you are saying, it's Ki, to Pi, dQi. So, what is the contact geometry?
Uh-huh.
And it's called?
Contact
geometry.
Contact.
So this one is called contact, one form. And it's... So now, what I really specify here is that this... Whereas this guy is completely independent of the Hamiltonian. You know, we can always define this data here. So this contact one will depend on what the Hamiltonian is. Right, so if I put theta h, if you want, it's pi dqi minus h dt. Okay, and finally, we have seen very briefly that in the Lagrangian picture, you can define Lagrange one form. And do you remember from yesterday what it was?
DL/dQ.
The L over the Q dot.
DQI.
Okay. So this is what it is. So look at, you know, the difference. So in some sense, you know that in, as you are going from Lagrangian picture to Hamiltonian one, the first thing you do that you say, well, this generalized momenta, which are defined by DL over the Q dot. Right? So this thing actually mimics whatever stands here. Pi dqi is basically the same thing. However, there's a big difference. Whereas here, B and Q are your coordinates, are completely independent of your concrete choice of dynamics, of what H is. So here, this thing actually depends on that. Right? So I have to be given L to find this thing. So this one it has, you know, much more ugly appearance, because I, in order to calculate it, I really need to use the specific form of L. Whereas here, I just have this universal prescription for that. That's why the Hamiltonian picture is nicer. Because here, I have, you know, something which is independent of L, whereas here, I have to calculate something more. Okay? So So of course, if I have one form, I can form the corresponding two form. And so it doesn't make any sense, but D of Cartan's form equals to the symplectic form. Okay, so symplectic form. Symplectic form. So symplectic, you know, it's non-degenerate and it's d omega equals to zero. So omega equals to d theta. So again, this thing will be completely independent of your dynamics. Because this one is. It's just dp dq. Right? Dp dash dq. So completely independent of dynamics. So this one is, if you want, non-degenerate. And of course, closed. Okay, and it's independent of your Hamiltonian. So the same thing here, but now this depends on h. All right, so we define again omega h is v theta h depends on the Hamiltonian. So it's a little bit more ugly. And of course, now it is sort of singular, but it's not singular, but it's degenerate, because there's this one direction where it is degenerate. So it's non-singular, non-singular, and d omega is to zero. And surprisingly, there is no name, so you can call it contact two form, but people don't do it. For some reason, I don't know. And similarly, here, and I haven't done that, but of course, it now makes sense. You can define Lagrange two form, Lagrange symplectic two form. So you define omega L to be d theta L. And again, it depends on L, right? So you can do that here. Okay, so now we have a two form. So finally, you are interested in your dynamical field. Right? So for your equations of motion, basically, equations of motion for dynamical fields, x, right? So what are the, so here you would say that is a dynamical field which depends now on the Hamiltonian. And the Boyle's equation, if I want to find this dynamical field x, and I know it's for omega, how do I find it?
It's minus d.
In the Hamiltonian picture?
X omega.
Yeah. So it's at x, h, hook, omega, equals to minus dh. Okay, so how do we find your field here. So of course the dynamical vector field will be different. This one will be different from that one because it lives in a bigger space, right? It can have three directions as well. And so this is defined as a null direction of omega. Okay, so this is your description. Because your omega already depends on the Hamiltonian, right? So this one already carries the information about the Hamiltonian. So that's why I'm just finding it as an eigenvector corresponding to this omega. Okay, so finally here you have the Lagrangian thing. And so you have seen yesterday that LXL theta L equals to DL is your correct equation. However, this is not very similar to what you have here. So you can, because I told you that you can actually define this symplectic two form Lagrange symplectic two form omega. So you would like to use this symplectic two form here to write something like this. And again, you know, the guideline is that, well, theta is basically theta here, but I just have to use L to define my P, right? So similarly, you know that you can define a Lagrangian energy, E, to be basically the Hamiltonian if you want, but now expressed in the Lagrangian picture, dl over dq dot j, u dot j minus l. So So that's basically your Hamiltonian, but you understand it as a function of Q and Q dot. Okay? And then you can show that this equation is equivalent to the equation XL omega L equals to minus DE. Okay? Well, precisely as you have here. Right? You can sort of believe that. Right? Because it's the same thing, but I'm now just writing it in a Lagrangian shape description. I'm writing it as a function of Q and Q dot. Instead, here I write it as a function of Q and Q. So actually, you know, Lagrangian thing has very, very simple description. However, it's more ugly because the thing which you start with already depends on the Lagrangian. Whereas here, this is independent of Hamiltonian, this is independent of Hamiltonian. And only the dependence on the Hamiltonian end is the final equation. That's why the Hamiltonian is sort of nicer. Okay, questions to this? So that's basically the summary of what we have done, and I hope I convince you that this is beautiful. Of course, there's this generalization of these things, the number mechanics, which waits for you to find applications, and I don't know if actually if it has contact version. Maybe it does. It's an interesting research project, maybe if it doesn't. So by the way, you know, there's lots of things going on in classical mechanics. It's not a dead field as you might think. Now, there's still lots of papers written on classical mechanics, especially on integrable systems, but also, you know, using various geometric things, defining other brackets and Poisson brackets, and so on, trying to generalize this to this quantum mechanics and so on. So it's an active research field, if you want, if you're interested in these things. So on the way, we have, of course, learned some of the differential geometry. And so this differential geometry is not good only for classical mechanics, but it's good for many things. Let me just, you know, briefly overview what it is good for. So differential geometry. So of course, the thing which you immediately see is the applications to general relativity, right? So general relativity. You know, interestingly, Einstein was the first one to think, you know, differential geometry is nonsense. I don't need it. Why Minkowski is obscuring my beautiful physical results by you know, putting it on Minkowski space and so on. But then he realized actually I need that description, and it was a painful experience for him. Because he actually had to learn differential geometry to create general relativity. And it was very, very painful because at the time it was not taught, it was not part of a course of theoretical physics. And so he had to do it on his own with his friend, Gassmann. If you read his letters, he's very, very, you know, desperate in learning these things. It was very difficult for him. So anyway, so GR, you'll see starting not next week, but week after that, we have seen classical mechanics. So that's what I show you. What I haven't shown you is that actually thermodynamics has beautiful description in terms of differential geometry. And the reason is the following. So if you, for example, consider the first law, GS equals to TdS, minus PdV. Okay? So you look at this. So you have always conjugate quantities. T and S are conjugate quantities. P and V are conjugate quantities. Okay? So this is like, if you want, T and P are like Qs, and S and V are like Ps. Okay? Right? So now, however, I have an extra one. I have E. So thermodynamics lives naturally on an all-dimensional space, because you have always two conjugate variables, Q and Ps, and then you have this extra one, T, if you want. So thermodynamics is natural description in terms of the contact geometry. Okay, or contact geometry. And I'll give you one reference if you're interested in this. For example, archive. Oh, it's not very readable, but it's okay. More than three, one. It has some references, so big references better. But anyway, so it's 0711 and then 4319, and where you can read about, you know, formulation of thermodynamics in the compact geometry language. Of course, it has applications to gauge theories. So we only briefly discussed fiber bundles, which the example of a fiber bundle is cotangent bundle or tangent bundle, all these things. So you will see that actually the connections, for example, the electromagnetic potential can be understood as a connection living on these fiber bundles. And so again, maybe you don't like that gray book, but it's a beautiful source if you actually, it's very concise, but it has beautiful description of, you know, how a mu can be understood geometrically. How for the electromagnetic potential, a mu can be understood geometrically. And of course, then the applications to mathematical physics. And you will see that you will learn soon that actually, if you talk about Dirac equation, which you will in a month, there are spinners and stuff like that. They are nothing else than differential forms. Okay, so there is something which is called Grassmann algebra. Which is the algebra obeyed by Dirac matrices. So, Dirac matrices, which you need to describe an electron, for example, Dirac matrices. And you will see that this algebra is nothing else than differential forms. So whatever you learn here, you know, can be immediately applied there. You know, another interesting application is the special manifolds, which I briefly discussed. You know, that's another field of research which is still very, very active, and you know, you can basically use whatever you learn in symplectic and compact geometry. And of course, string theory has beautiful applications to geometry, to differential geometry. So there's many things. So now what immediately evades you, so that's basically where the differential, as many more, but I just wanted to mention these. Okay. Especially the thermodynamics, I think is a beautiful one. So whatever you learn, actually, you will apply later on, so some other things. So what immediately actually evades you is, of course, now quantum mechanics course. So what you basically will do that you take your quantum brackets, you change them to commutators, and you switch to Q and P to Q hat and P hat, and that's what actually is the quantum mechanics course about, right? Very briefly, the direct consequence, trivial consequence of this. You will have your quantum field theory course, where you basically replace your Euler Lagrange equations. So in quantum field theory, you just replace your Euler Lagrange equation, dl over dt minus d over dt, dl over d, that's something stupid, dl over dq, dl over dq dot equals to zero. So, you know, in mechanics, you have q as a function of t, generalized coordinate function of time. Now we go to a field, which is function of space-time, by x and t, right? And so the directionalization of this will go as, so now you have Lagrangian density, but it's basically Lagrangian if you want. And so you differentiate this with respect to the field, dl over d phi, minus, so now this is your basically your space-time. So now you have to replace d over dt is the whole thing here. So it'll be dx mu, where x mu will have t and x, right? So it's minus d over dx mu, and dl over, now again, d here, and then d phi over dx mu equals to zero. So that's your Euler Lagrange equation in the field theory. So you are basically doing the same thing, but now, you know, not only in time, but also in space, right? And finally, you will actually discuss your GR thing, which again, starts in 2 weeks. So let me just stress this really this beautiful difference between the things. So in classical mechanics, what we've seen that the central object is, the central object is omega, right? Central object is omega, which was a 2-form, meaning so it was non-degenerate, it was anti-symmetric, okay, which means that if I swap the two indices, I get a minus sign, right? And it satisfies d of omega goes to zero. So that's your classical mechanics. My postulate is that the omega, which is non-degenerate anti-symmetric, can satisfy some differential equation. So now if you go to GR, basically the same thing. So now you say that the central object, which describes the gravity, the gravitational field, is not omega, but it's called G, is the metric, okay? Which is again non-degenerate. Now the difference is that it's not anti-symmetric, but it's symmetric. Okay? It's symmetric. Meaning, if I have two indices, g, alpha, and beta, if I swap them, nothing happens. I don't pick up a sign. Okay? And the analog of this will be lambda on g equals to zero. But this is not the exterior derivative, but the covariant derivative. But that's both what g is. You see the immediate parallel between things. So let me stop here, and thank you so much for attending this.